Disc 24. In the late 1790s, the unceasing demands of a growing family prevented Eliza from a full-scale commitment to Christian charity work. On November 26, 1799, she gave birth to her seventh child, Eliza, but she continued to shelter strays and waifs, a practice that she and Alexander had started in adopting Fanny Antill. In 1795, Eliza's brother, John Bradstreet Schuyler, had died, leaving a son, Philip Schuyler II. During the week, the boy attended school on Staten Island with the Hamilton boys and then spent weekends with Uncle Alexander and Aunt Eliza. So Eliza's home was always bursting with youngsters demanding attention. Eliza was never allowed to forget the Reynolds affair, since the Republican press refreshed the public's memory at every opportunity. In December 1799, the Aurora pointed out gleefully that General Hamilton had arrived in Philadelphia after some recent sightings of his former mistress, implying that the affair continued. Mrs. Reynolds, alias Mariah, the sentimental heroine of the memorable Vindication, is said to be in Philadelphia once more. In the early part of last year, she was in town and had the imprudence to intrude herself on women of virtue with a relation of her story that she was the Mariah. In fact, Hamilton had never again set eyes on his quondam mistress. The ever-shifting Mariah Reynolds had recreated herself as a widow named Mariah Clement. In an attempt to gain respectability in Philadelphia, she ran the household of a French doctor. Nevertheless, the Republican papers continued to ride their favorite hobby horse, intimating that her romance with Hamilton still flourished. Hamilton found increasing pleasure at home at 26 Broadway. One senses that he and Eliza clung to each other with a deep sense of mutual need. I am well aware how much in my absence your affectionate and anxious heart needs the consolation of frequently hearing from me, and there is no consolation which I am not very much disposed to administer to it, he told Eliza in one letter. It deserves everything from me. I am much more in debt to you than I can ever pay, but my future life will be more than ever devoted to your happiness. The more despairing he became about politics and human nature, and his worldview was never very rosy to begin with, the more he appreciated his sincere, unpretentious wife. From Philadelphia, he wrote to her, "You are my good genius of that kind which the ancient philosophers called a familiar, and you know very well that I am glad to be in every way as familiar as possible with you." He concluded, "Adieu, best of wives and best of mothers." Even a rugged soldier's life, once his sovereign remedy for all ills, no longer possessed its curative powers. "I discover more and more that I am spoiled for a military man," he told Eliza. "My health and comfort require that I should be at that home where I am always sure to find a sweet asylum from care and pain in your bosom." Hamilton never stopped doting on Angelica Church. During one stay with his in-laws in Albany, he found himself seated at dinner opposite a John Trumbull portrait of her and her son Philip. Hamilton sent Angelica a witty letter describing how he had dined in the mute presence of a special lady friend. "I was placed directly in front of her and was much occupied with her during the whole dinner. She did not appear to her usual advantage, and yet she was very interesting. The eloquence of silence is not a common attribute of hers, but on this occasion she employed it perforce, and it was not considered as a fault. Though I am fond of hearing her speak, her silence was so well placed that I did not attempt to make her break it. You will conjecture that I must have been myself dumb with admiration." Hamilton was approaching his mid-40s and perhaps feeling his age. His high-pressure life was still packed with plenty of responsibilities. As Inspector General, he bore single-handedly the weight of an entire army while trying to retain his restive legal clients. "The law has nearly abandoned him, or rather, he has forsaken it," Robert Troop told Rufus King. "The loss he sustains is immense." Hamilton's life began to lose some of its clockwork precision, and the darkness of depression again invaded his mind. While staying with Oliver Wolcott Jr. in November 1798, Hamilton watched the emaciated Mrs. Wolcott wasting away from a terminal disease. He confessed to Eliza that he was haunted by despondent thoughts that he could not shake. "I am quite well, But I know not what impertinent gloom hangs over my mind, which I fear will not be entirely dissipated until I rejoin my family. A letter from you telling me that you and my dear children are well will be a consolation. During one trip, he told Angelica Church of a sadness which took possession of his heart after leaving New York. These confessional remarks leap off the page because Hamilton seldom admitted to anxiety in this candid manner and tended to shield his innermost thoughts. Now an invalid crippled by gout and abdominal troubles, Philip Schuyler worried about the punishing demands that his son-in-law made on himself. In early 1799, he again exhorted Hamilton to relax. "Mrs. Church writes me that you suffer from want of exercise, that this and unremitted attention to business injures your health. I believe it is difficult for an active mind to moderate an application to business, but, my dear sir, you must make some sacrifice to that health which is so precious to all who are dear to you, and to that country which reveres and esteems you. Let me then entreat you to use more bodily exercise and less of that of the mind." Schuyler discreetly exhorted Eliza to saddle Hamilton's horse every day and get him to ride in the fresh air. Hamilton did engage in some outdoor recreation. He had recently bought a rifle and liked to go out hunting with a retriever dog named Old Peggy. With his fowling piece in hand, a light gun with A. Hamilton, N.Y. carved into its stock, he sometimes roamed the Harlem forests, searching for birds to shoot. At other times, he prowled the Hudson, fishing for striped bass. He was still an habitué of the theater, whether classical tragedies or lighter fare, and he attended the Philharmonic Society concerts at Snow's Hotel on Broadway. Hamilton's problem was never a shortage of interests so much as the time to cultivate them. On occasion, Hamilton gave evidence of a prankish spirit at odds with the image of the sober public man. While on a visit to Newark, Hamilton's aide, Philip Church, met a Polish poet, Julian Niemczewicz, a friend of General Tadeusz Kosciuszko. Niemczewicz insisted that Kosciuszko had entrusted him with a magic secret that permitted him to summon up spirits from the grave. Hamilton, intrigued, invited the Polish poet to a Friday evening soiree. To give conclusive proof of his black art, Niemczewicz asked Hamilton to step into an adjoining room so that he could not see what was going on. Then one guest wrote down on a card the name of a dead warrior, the Baron de Viomenil, who had seen action at Yorktown, and asked the Polish poet to conjure up his shade. Niemczewicz uttered a string of incantations accompanied by a constantly clanging bell. When it was over, Hamilton strode into the room and declared that the Baron de Viomenil had appeared to him exactly in the dress which he formerly wore and that a conversation had passed between them which he was not at liberty to disclose, related Peter Jay, the governor's son. That Hamilton had communed with a fallen comrade attracted exceptional attention in New York society, so much so that he had to admit that it was all a hoax he had cooked up with Philip Church and Niemczewicz to frighten the family for amusement, and that it was never intended to be made public. The yellow fever epidemic of 1798 that had claimed the lives of Benjamin Franklin Bache and John Fenno had also given fresh urgency to the work of the Widows' Society, as many women lost their family breadwinners. "None but eyewitnesses," Isabella Graham wrote, "could have imagined the sufferings of so many respectable, industrious women who never thought to ask bread of any but of God." This same scourge led the more profane Aaron Burr to create quite a different sort of institution in New York, the Manhattan Company. To understand this pivotal moment between Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton, one must fathom the severity of the epidemic that had struck the city that autumn. In September, as many as 45 victims perished per day, and Hamilton and his family even briefly took rooms several miles from town. Robert Troup described the terrifying paralysis that gripped New York. "Our courts are shut up, our trade totally stagnant, and we have little or no appearance of business. I call in once a day at Hamilton's, and we endeavor to fortify each other with philosophy to bear the ills we cannot cure." Wealthier residents escaped to rural outskirts, while the poor were exposed to a disease spread by mosquitoes that multiplied around the many swamps and stagnant ponds. Almost 2,000 New Yorkers died, and a fresh potter's field was consecrated in what is now Greenwich Village. Aaron Burr's brother-in-law, Dr. Joseph Brown, blamed contaminated water for the recurrent outbreaks of yellow fever. The city still depended on often polluted wells, and submitted a plan to the Common Council for drawing fresh water from the Bronx River. Brown's plan contemplated the creation of a private water corporation chartered by the state legislature. The pipe water was also hailed as a panacea for other civic needs, ranging from fighting fires to washing filthy streets. Although the Common Council applauded the basic concept of a water company, it countered with a proposal for a public company to conduct this business. In reality, Brown's plan was a ruse concocted by Burr, who had no interest whatever in pure water, but considerable interest in setting up a Republican bank. Among the many putative advantages Hamilton and his Federalist associates enjoyed in New York politics was a virtual monopoly over local banking. At the start of 1799, both of the banks in New York City happened to be the brainchildren of Alexander Hamilton, the Bank of New York and the local branch of the Bank of the United States. Republican businessmen nursed a perennial grievance that these banks discriminated against them, one Republican journalist charging that it became at length impossible for men engaged in trade to advocate Republican sentiments without sustaining material injury. As the rage and violence of party increased, directors became more rigorous in enforcing their system of exclusion. It is not clear that Republicans were actually penalized, but the suspicion was certainly abroad. Hamilton opposed the vogue for state banks that proliferated in the 1790s, less from narrow political motives than from a fear that competition among banks would dilute credit standards and invite imprudent lending practices as bankers vied for clients. Now a member of the New York Assembly, Burr knew that any politician who smashed the Federalist monopoly in local banking would attain heroic status among Republicans, at least those who did not regard banks as diabolical instruments. Easy access to a bank also appealed to an incorrigible spendthrift such as Burr, who had ongoing money problems. In early 1797, toward the end of his term in the U.S. Senate, his financial troubles had grown so acute that he had neglected his legislative duties. To establish a New York bank, he had to scale a very high hurdle. The state legislature conferred bank charters, and it was currently under Federalist sway. In those days, every New York corporation engaged in business needed a legislative charter. As the crafty Burr cast about for a stratagem that would let him sneak a bank charter past the opposition party, he hit upon the unlikely subterfuge of using the proposed water company as a blind. In a cunning political sleight of hand, Burr lined up a bipartisan coalition of six luminaries, three Republicans and three Federalists, to approach the Common Council as sponsors of his proposal for a private water company. For his Federalist phalanx, he recruited Julian Verplank, president of the Bank of New York, John Murray, president of the Chamber of Commerce, and his greatest prize, Major General Alexander Hamilton. Why did Hamilton go along with Burr? Burr had recently flirted with the Federalists and had cooperated with Hamilton to fortify New York City against a French invasion. For the moment, the two men stood on a relatively good footing. Hamilton had survived yellow fever and would have favored a project to save the city from further epidemics. Hamilton may also have been investigating a business opportunity for John B. Church. Angelica had prodded her husband to give up his parliamentary career and return to America, but now Church seemed bored, if fabulously prosperous, in New York. Hamilton noted, "He has little to do, and time hangs heavy on his hands." Church emerged as a director of the Manhattan Company, which may have been a precondition for Hamilton's participation. Whatever Hamilton's motives, one Burr biographer has written, no member of the Committee of Six worked harder than Hamilton to make possible Aaron Burr's upcoming triumph in the New York legislature. On February 22, 1799, Hamilton and Burr marched into the office of Mayor Richard Varick to plead the water company's case. After conferring with an English canal engineer, Hamilton drew up an impressive memo that went far beyond waterworks to a systematic plan for draining city swamps and installing sewers. Persuaded by Hamilton, the Common Council ceded the final decision to the state legislature. Burr must have savored the situation. He was exploiting Alexander Hamilton and enlisting his foe's mighty pen in a clandestine Republican cause. It was exactly the sort of joke that the drolly, mysterious Burr treasured. He also got Hamilton to prepare a memo for the state legislature in support of a private water company. In late March, obliging state legislators approved the creation of the Manhattan Company, and on April 2nd, an unsuspecting Governor John Jay signed this act into law. Earlier promises about the company providing free water to combat fires and repair city streets damaged by laying pipes, standard features of water company contracts in other states, had been quietly deleted by Burr from the final bill. As usual, the devil lay in the details. At the final moment, with many legislators having departed for home and others too lazy to examine the fine print, Burr embedded a brief provision in the bill that widened immeasurably the scope of future company activities. This momentous language said that it shall and may be lawful for the said company to employ all such surplus capital as may belong or accrue to the said company in the purchase of public or other stock or in any other moneyed transactions of operations. The surplus capital loophole would allow Burr to use the Manhattan Company as a bank or any other kind of financial institution. The Federalists had dozed right through this deception because they knew of the Republican antipathy for banks, and also because Burr had cleverly decorated the board with eminent Federalists. Burr, it turned out, was too smart for his own good. If some Republicans admired his finesse, the general electorate did not. At the end of April, as he faced a re-election campaign for his assembly seat, voters grasped the magnitude of his deception and shunned the ticket he headed. Once Hamilton realized that Burr had hoodwinked him, he was livid. He later complained of Burr, "I have been present when he has contended against banking systems with earnestness and with the same arguments that Jefferson would use. Yet he has lately, by a trick, established a bank, a perfect monster in its principles, but a very convenient instrument of profit and influence." Even some stalwart Republicans shuddered at Burr's machinations. Of Burr's discredited slate, Peter R. Livingston commented that it would hardly be a wonder if they did lose the election, for they had such a damned ticket that no decent man could hold up his head to support it. Burr's editor, Mary Jo Klein, has observed that the Manhattan Company scheme was so baldly self-serving that it temporarily halted Burr's political career and lost him the public office that had served him so well. On April 22nd, when Manhattan Company shares went on sale, they were instantly snapped up. In early September, dropping any pretense that it was principally a water company, the company opened with great fanfare its new Office of Discount and Deposit on Wall Street. This bank immediately posed a competitive threat to the Bank of New York, now housed in an elegant two-story building down the block at Wall and William Streets. By its wondrously vague charter, a magic carpet of corporate possibilities, the Manhattan Company was allowed to raise $2 million, operate anywhere, and go on in perpetuity, whereas the Bank of New York had less than $1 million in capital, was restricted to operations in the city, and had a charter that expired in 1811. To purchase the favor of all political cliques, Burr shrewdly parceled out the company's 12 directorships, dispensing 9 to Republicans, with places carefully allocated for Clintonians, Livingstons, and Burrites, and 3 to Federalists, including John Barker Church. Perhaps the least of Aaron Burr's sins in organizing the Manhattan Company was his having gulled Hamilton and state legislators into granting a bank charter under false pretenses. Far more grievous were the fraudulent claims he had made for a water company. The plan set forth by Joseph Brown to rid the city of yellow fever by delivering fresh water proved a sham in Burr's nimble hands. In July 1799, the betrayed Brown wrote pathetically to Burr, "I expect and hope that enough will be done to satisfy the public and particularly the legislature that the institution is not a speculating job, but an undertaking from whence will result immediate and incalculable advantages to the city of New York." The doctor was swiftly disabused. The Manhattan Company promptly scrapped plans to bring water from the Bronx River. The directors had already raided its surplus capital for the bank and instead drew impure water from old wells, pumping it through wooden pipes. That summer, yellow fever returned to New York with a vengeance. Not only had Burr's plan failed to provide pure water, but had thwarted other sound plans afoot, including those for a municipal water company. The day after the Manhattan Company inaugurated business on Wall Street, two of its directors, Aaron Burr and John Barker Church, celebrated the event in idiosyncratic fashion, with a duel. A staunch Federalist, Church was an opinionated, quarrelsome man who never shrank from a good fight and was not averse to duels. One theory of why he had fled from England to America on the eve of the Revolution, adopting the pseudonym of John B. Carter, was that he had killed a man during a London duel. The present feud arose from unguarded language that Church used about Burr at a private table in town, as one New York newspaper daintily put it. Church's comments referred to illicit services performed by Burr for the Holland Company, which speculated in American property on behalf of Dutch banks. The Holland Company felt hobbled by restrictions placed on New York land owned by foreigners and retained Burr as a lobbyist to deal with this impediment. Never one to idealize human nature, Burr recommended to his client that it sprinkle $5,000 around the state legislature to brighten the prospects for corrective legislation. The money worked wonders, and the consequent Alien Landowners Act removed the legal obstacles. On the Holland Company's ledgers, the payment to Burr appeared not as a bribe, but as an unpaid loan. As an attorney for the Holland Company, Hamilton would have known about this seamy affair and likely conveyed his findings to John Barker Church. In discussing Burr's behavior, John Barker Church made the unpardonable error of employing the word bribery in mixed company. Troop reported in early September, a day or two ago, Mr. Church in some company intimated that Burr had been bribed for his influence whilst in the legislature to procure the passing of the act permitting the Holland Company to hold their lands. The allegation against Burr, Troop added, was widely believed. The instant Burr heard about Church's derogatory remarks, he called him to a duel. Church was a quick, decisive personality. In Hamilton's words, a man of strong mind, very exact, very active, and very much a man of business, and forthwith took up the challenge. Burr's actions could only have aggravated Hamilton's fury about the Manhattan Company fiasco. Burr's challenge to John B. Church seems rash until one realizes that he was eyeing the presidential election the following year. His short-lived flirtation with the Federalists had ended. After his humbling setback in the assembly race due to the Manhattan Company, he had to remove this fresh blemish from his reputation, and a duel with Hamilton's brother-in-law promised to embellish his image in Republican circles. The speed with which Burr entered the duel suggests that, unlike in his later confrontation with Hamilton, he had no murderous intent and went through the ritual purely for political effect. It was a very different affair of honor from one the previous year after Republican Brockholst Livingston had been attacked by Federalist James Jones as he ambled along the Battery. Jones pounced on him, thrashed him with a cane, and gave his nose a good twist. Livingston, in revenge, summoned him to a dueling ground in New Jersey and shot him dead. On September 2, 1799, Burr and Church rode across the Hudson for a sunset duel. Burr chatted affably with Church and sauntered about the field of honor with sang-froid. One observer said there was not the least alteration in his, Burr's, behavior on the ground from what there would have been had they met on friendly terms. Church chose Abijah Hammond, former treasurer of the Society for Establishing Useful Manufactures, for his second, while Burr turned to Hamilton's old nemesis, Edenus Burke. That Burr's second came from South Carolina heightens the suspicion that he was trying to woo Southern Republicans with the duel. Contrary to legend, the encounter was not fought with pistols owned by Church and later used in the Hamilton-Burr affair. We know that the pistols belonged to Burr because of a comic mishap. Burr had explained privately to Burke that the bullets he had brought were too small for the pistols and needed to be wrapped in greased chamois leather. As the duel was about to begin, Burr saw Burke trying to tamp the bullet into the barrel by tapping the ramrod with a stone. Burke whispered an apology to Burr. "I forgot to grease the leather. But you see, he, Church, is ready. Don't keep him waiting. Just take a crack as it is, and I'll grease the next." In his coolly unruffled style, Burr told Burke not to worry. If he missed Church, he would hit him the second time. Burr then took the pistol, bowed to Burke, and measured off 10 paces with Church. That Burr would fight with an imperfectly loaded weapon suggests that the mood at Hoboken was hardly homicidal on either side. It also would have been poor advertising for the Manhattan Company if one of its directors had murdered another during its gala opening week. The two men raised their pistols and fired simultaneously. Church's shot clipped a button from Burr's coat while Burr's missed Church altogether. As the 2 seconds stoked the pistols with fresh shot, Church stepped forward and apologized to Burr for his statements. According to Troop, Church declared he had been indiscreet and was sorry for it. This was not a retraction or outright admission of error, but it indicated that Church knew that he had no definite proof of the bribery charge. As if eager to terminate the duel, Burr professed satisfaction at this sop. The two men shook hands, ending the duel, and the principals and seconds rode back to Manhattan in high spirits. The Church-Burr duel forms an instructive contrast with the later Hamilton-Burr duel. It was hastily arranged and devoid of the often torturous negotiations that attended more serious affairs of honor. It was halted at an early opportunity, with both sides seemingly keen to quit and hurry back to Manhattan. It was Church who proved the expert shot, while Burr did not even wing his opponent, or perhaps did not try to. Most important, the duel did not throb with the uncontainable passion, hatred, and high drama that was to shadow the encounter in Weehawken nearly 5 years later. One wonders whether Hamilton formed any lasting impressions of Burr based on this duel. If so, they would all have been wrong, for Burr had come off as both a poor shot and a reasonable man, not as a skilled marksman who might arrive at the field of honor prepared to shoot with deadly intent. Chapter 34, In an Evil Hour. The mighty provisional army that Alexander Hamilton was trying to muster was based on a simple premise, that a hostile France, having spurned negotiations with the United States, might embark on war. That premise seemed far more questionable during the winter of 1798 to 1799. The French realized they had blundered in the XYZ affair and did not wish to antagonize President Adams any further. After John Marshall and Charles Cotesworth Pinckney returned from France, the delegation's third member, however, Elbridge Gerry, dawdled in Paris. Like most Republicans, Gerry worried that war with France would drive America into Great Britain's embrace. Gerry was a notoriously cranky personality. Small, squint-eyed, and argumentative, hindered by a stutter in debate, he had a talent for both offending and mystifying people. He favored two capitals, for instance, with a dazed Congress shuttling between them. Poor Gerry always had a wrong kink in his head, Abigail Adams observed. For all his crotchety eccentricity, however, Elbridge Gerry had a warm admirer in John Adams, who felt oppressed by the mounting cost of military preparations and public disquiet over the property taxes enacted to pay for them. So when Gerry told Adams in October 1798 that the French desired peace, Adams took him seriously. Hamilton and his Confederates in the Adams cabinet tended to brush aside such tidings as cynical, tactical maneuvers by the French. "Such inveterate prejudice shocked me," Adams later wrote, though he himself had earlier been skeptical of French overtures. "I said nothing, but was determined I would not be the slave of it. I knew the man, Gerry, infinitely better than all of them." Adams had no doubt who was leading the campaign to discredit Gerry. No man had a greater share in propagating and diffusing these prejudices against Mr. Gerry than Hamilton. In early December 1798, with both Washington and Hamilton present, Adams made a somewhat conciliatory address to Congress, declaring that the French government had in a qualified manner declared itself willing to receive a minister from the United States for the purpose of restoring a good understanding. Many Federalists were aghast that Adams held out an olive branch to France, while many Republicans still found the president too hawkish. As architect of an army designed to rebuff the French menace, Hamilton was naturally ambivalent about anything that appeared to lessen the danger. He insisted that if the French threat had subsided, it was only because of military efforts undertaken thus far. Hamilton told Harrison Gray Otis that if negotiations did not take place in earnest by August, the president should be given authority to declare war against France. Nonetheless, Adams leaned toward a diplomatic solution, and Secretary of War McHenry apprised Hamilton that in reviewing the new army's progress with Adams, the president seemed to insinuate the affair need not be hurried. Hamilton saw that sluggishness in organizing the army stemmed from Adams himself, and told Washington that obstacles of a very peculiar kind stand in the way of an efficient and successful management of our military concerns. Because the new army was headed by his rivals, Washington and Hamilton, it brought out all of Adams's competitive instincts, suspicions, and unappeasable vanity. One day in early February 1799, Theodore Sedgwick, the incoming Federalist Speaker of the House, raised with Adams the seemingly innocuous question of whether Washington should bear the title general in the new army. This ignited a temper tantrum in the president. "What? Are you going to appoint him general over the president?" Adams asked, his voice rising. "I have not been so blind, but I have seen a combined effort among those who call themselves the friends of government to annihilate the essential powers given by the president." These outbursts were transmitted back to Hamilton. Then on February 18, 1799, President Adams stirred up a still greater political tempest by taking what David McCullough has justly praised as the most decisive action of his presidency. He sent a messenger to Vice President Jefferson, who read aloud in the Senate a short but startling note from the president. Having decided to give diplomacy a second chance, Adams had nominated William Vance Murray, the American minister at The Hague, as minister plenipotentiary to France. It was a typical Adams decision, solitary, impulsive, and quirky. Before springing this decision, he had not conferred with his cabinet, who had previously warned him that such a move would be an act of humiliation. "I beg you to be assured that it is wholly his own act, without any participation or communication with any of us," Secretary of State Pickering told Hamilton. Time was to vindicate the enlightened nature of Adams's decision, but the manner of making it only aggravated tensions with his cabinet members. When they proved skeptical about French peace overtures, Adams decided to question their loyalty. He began to suspect a dark treachery within his cabinet, a cabal that sought nothing less than the annihilation of his constitutional powers, wrote biographer John Ferling. Yet Adams stuck with his strange decision to both retain and ignore his unreliable cabinet when he should either have consulted them or fired them. Adams's decision also shattered any semblance of unity between many Federalists and the president. When a thunderstruck delegation of senators asked Adams to explain the Murray appointment, he grew brusquely combative. As Pickering related, the moment they announced the purpose of their visit, Mr. Adams burst into a violent passion, and instead of giving any explanation, he upbraided the committee as stepping out of their proper sphere in making the inquiry. Theodore Sedgwick and the president ended up shouting at each other, with Sedgwick attributing Adams's decision to the wild and irregular starts of a vain, jealous, and half-frantic mind. After these wounding confrontations, Adams beat a hasty retreat to Quincy and stayed there for 7 months, sometimes buried in the collected works of Frederick the Great. Federalist Robert G. Harper of South Carolina said that he hoped that en route to Quincy, the president's horses might run wild and break their master's neck. Adams's diplomatic initiative threatened plans for a grand new army, and Hamilton said tartly that it would astonish if anything from that quarter could astonish. Both the style and substance of the presidential turnabout bothered him. He thought the decision came not from careful forethought, but from the fortuitous emanations of momentary impulses. He believed that Adams should have consulted his cabinet, and that any negotiations should have occurred on American soil. Hamilton had a low opinion of William Vance Murray, a Maryland lawyer. "Murray is certainly not strong enough for so immensely important a mission," Hamilton stated, and he lobbied to have him incorporated into a three-man commission. Hamilton prevailed, and Adams agreed grudgingly to have two envoys accompany Murray: Oliver Ellsworth, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and William Davey, the Federalist Governor of North Carolina. For loyalty's sake, the Federalists supported this commission, but the damage to party unity was severe. Adams had again flouted the Federalists in his cabinet and in Congress, and had jettisoned the one issue that had united the party, the threat of Jacobinism. Henceforth, it was no longer self-evident that Adams would enjoy unanimous Federalist backing in his 1800 re-election campaign. Troop echoed many Federalists when he said, "The late nomination of the president for the purpose of renewing negotiations with France has given almost universal disgust. There certainly will be serious difficulties in supporting Mr. Adams at the next election if he should be a candidate." Rumors made the rounds about the president's erratic behavior, with some even questioning his sanity. In another shift that boded ill for Hamilton, George Washington cooled perceptibly in his enthusiasm for the new armed force. Had the army been raised right after the outcry over the XYZ dispatches, he told Hamilton, there would have been no trouble gathering recruits. Now the measure is not only viewed with indifference, but deemed unnecessary by that class of people who might have served. With each new letter to Hamilton, Washington sounded more dubious, beginning one message on this pessimistic note. "In the present state of the army, or more properly, the embryo of one, for I do not perceive from anything that has come to my knowledge that we are likely to move beyond this." Despite his dismay, Hamilton persisted with plans for his army, however bleak the chances it would ever materialize. He worried that Napoleon might attempt a sneak attack on an American port and that the country would be caught off guard. He got bogged down in bickering about petty details, telling McHenry that he was disappointed and distressed by a shipment of cocked hats ordered for one regiment. He lectured him pedantically that cocked hats must be cocked on all three sides. "But the hats received are only capable of being cocked on one side, and the brim is otherwise so narrow as to consult neither good appearance nor utility. They are also without cockades and loops." The depression that had afflicted Hamilton the previous fall worsened, and he turned moody and snappish with McHenry about his procurement of supplies. Ever the perfectionist, Hamilton complained that he was starved for funds and felt plunged back into the worst days of the Continental Army. Aside from Philip Church, he had only one secretary and had to handle much of the correspondence by himself. What was unusual for Hamilton was the haughty, almost sadistic tone that he took when writing to his longtime friend McHenry. These bilious outbursts make for painful reading, with Hamilton sounding like a stern schoolmaster fed up with a doltish pupil. "The fact is that the management of your agents as to the affair of supplies is ridiculously bad," Hamilton told him in one letter. He constantly pointed out errors in McHenry's procedures and never spared his feelings. Complicating matters was the reluctance of Treasury Secretary Wolcott to provide money for equipping the army. McHenry told Hamilton that he and Pickering had not been able to remove any one of the prejudices entertained by the Secretary of the Treasury against the augmentation of the army. "It is a pity, my dear sir, and a reproach, that our administration have no general plan," Hamilton replied. He made clear that he still meditated assorted military adventures. "Besides eventual security against invasion, we ought certainly to look to the possession of the Floridas and Louisiana, and we ought to squint at South America." Once upon a time, Hamilton had encouraged the cabinet to defer to Adams. Now he broke ranks and encouraged outright resistance. "If the chief is too desultory," he told McHenry, "his ministers ought to be the more united and steady and well settled in some reasonable system of measures." As if competitive with Adams and blatantly envious of his power, Hamilton became more zealous in pushing his views and interfering in internal cabinet politics. By late June 1799, he told McHenry more or less openly that if the president did not hold correct opinions, he should be ignored. If Hamilton incontestably betrayed Adams, the reverse was also true. Congress had authorized the president to boost the army by more than 10,000 men, yet Adams had scarcely lifted a finger to help Hamilton raise these new regiments, and a scant 2,000 men were enlisted by summer's end in 1799. Hamilton never reached even half the number that he was legally authorized to muster. By October, many troops had not been paid for 6 months, and a shortage of money threatened to halt recruiting efforts. As if such setbacks weren't enough, Hamilton had personal money problems. Despite his low pay, he had been unable to take on lucrative new legal clients. "I cannot be a general and a practicer of the law at the same time without doing injustice to the government and myself," he told McHenry. He laid out money for fuel and servants for his army office, but did not think he should have to pay for the new office that he needed. "You must not think me rapacious," he told McHenry. "I have not changed my character, but my situation as commanding general exposes me to much additional expense in entertaining officers." To this, he added the consideration of a wife and 6 children whose maintenance and education are to be taken care of. Hamilton felt demeaned, ignored, and unappreciated during his military service under Adams. Escaping from his duties to Quincy, Adams was also morose and irritable during the spring and summer of 1799. It is hard to comprehend the length of his Marathon stay. Adams was tending an ailing, rheumatic Abigail. The previous year, he had worried that the affliction might prove mortal, but as president, he did not enjoy the luxury of nursing his wife for 7 months. Biographer Joseph Ellis has speculated that Adams may have wanted to stall the peace mission until conditions had sufficiently improved in France. Whatever the case, the president's appetite was poor, he lost weight, and his patience grew short. John Ferling has given this vivid portrait of how overwrought Adams became during this period. "At times he was so irascible that Abigail thought it unwise even to permit him to see state documents. He acted the perfect curmudgeon, snapping at his wife and the hired help, and treating old acquaintances and well-wishers in a contemptible and uncivil manner. When General Knox and 2 others called on him, he refused to engage in conversation, reading the newspaper instead while they stared uncomfortably at one another. One morning, a group of naval officers and Harvard students rode out from Boston, hoping for an appearance, and if they were lucky, a few brief remarks by the president. He did appear at his front door, but only to tongue-lash them for their insolence at coming to his estate without an invitation. The men were mortified at the president's conduct," Abigail wrote, "and she was embarrassed for him." Prior to the fall of 1799, Hamilton and Adams had managed to avoid a showdown partly by steering clear of each other. Their paths converged in a fateful way that fall. Navy Secretary Benjamin Stoddart implored Adams to terminate his self-imposed exile and return to the capital, where artful, designing men were trying to subvert his peace initiative with France. Adams finally headed south in early October. On his way, he tarried in New York for a harrowing encounter with his son Charles, who had succumbed to alcoholism and bankruptcy. Adams had once chided his son as a madman possessed of the devil and dismissed him to Abigail as a mere rake, buck, blood, and beast. Now he vowed to Charles that he would never see him again, and he was to remain true to his word. This unfortunate episode could have only darkened the president's mood before his encounter with Hamilton. Another yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia had sent the government scurrying into temporary exile in Trenton, crowding the little town with government employees and military men. Suffering from a bad cold, President Adams lodged in a boarding house and made do with a small bedroom and sitting room. He arrived in Trenton hoping to break a logjam that had developed over the French peace mission. At first, he had been disturbed by evidence of fresh intrigue in the Directory that summer, telling Pickering, "The revolution in the Directory and the revival of the clubs and private societies in France seem to warrant a relaxation of our zeal for the sudden and hasty departure of our envoys." On October 15th, however, in a session that lasted until nearly midnight, Adams gathered his cabinet to confer final approval upon the Peace Commission. The next morning, he ordered the 3 envoys to sail by early November. Hamilton decided to hazard 1 last frantic effort to change the president's mind, a confrontation that neither ever forgot. In recounting the origins of this stormy session, Adams claimed that Hamilton had been training his troops at Newark when he learned of the cabinet decision. He said that Hamilton had ridden for 2 days and galloped unannounced into Trenton in a churlish breach of etiquette. Hamilton's appearance was altogether unforeseen, unrequested, and undesired. It was a sample of his habitual impudence. Hamilton's correspondence shows, however, that by October 8th he was already in Trenton on War Department business to confer with General Wilkinson about western fortifications, and he may well have stayed there. Hamilton denied Adams's insinuation that he was there as part of some mischievous plot against his independence. While in Trenton, he heard about the cabinet decision to dispatch the peace mission to France. As commanding general of an army created to ward off a French invasion, he naturally wanted to consult with the president. And as the de facto leader of the president's own party and a man with a considerable ego, he thought he was entitled to the president's ear. Adams thought Hamilton was being pushy and overbearing. He regarded his intervention as a breach of presidential prerogative and dangerous meddling with civilian policy by a military man. He also worried that Hamilton wanted to use his new army against his southern foes. Abigail Adams went so far as to fear that Hamilton might stage a coup d'etat against her husband's administration. The climactic encounter between Adams and Hamilton probably unfolded in a parlor of the boarding house where the president was staying. The conversation dragged on for hours. If Adams's account is accurate, the little man, as he called Hamilton, spoke with vehement eloquence and was wrought up to a degree of heat and effervescence. Adams probably did not exaggerate. During this period, Hamilton was often agitated, despondent, and gripped by strong emotions. Adams recalled that he reacted calmly to Hamilton, as if indulging a madman. "I heard him with perfect good humor, though never in my life did I hear a man talk more like a fool." Hamilton tried to persuade Adams that changes in the directory presaged a possible restoration of Louis XVIII to the French throne by Christmas. Adams replied caustically, "I should as soon expect that the sun, moon, and stars will fall from their orbs as events of that kind take place in any such period." Adams was correct. Louis XVIII was not to reign for another 15 years. On the other hand, Adams erred in thinking that a European peace would prevail by winter. "I treated him throughout with great mildness and civility," Adams concluded, "but after he took leave, I could not help reflecting in my own mind on the total ignorance he had betrayed of everything in Europe, in France, England, and elsewhere." Hamilton was stunned by Adams's altered stance toward France. Within the space of a month, the president had seemed to go from deep concern about the changed government in Paris to cavalier indifference. "The president has resolved to send the commissioners to France, notwithstanding the change of affairs there," he told George Washington. "All my calculations lead me to regret the measure." When Hamilton noted that Adams had not consulted his war or treasury secretary, Washington sounded equally critical. "I was surprised at the measure. How much more so at the manner of it," he told Hamilton. "This business seems to have commenced in an evil hour and under unfavorable auspices." After his meetings in Trenton, Hamilton returned to New York, pausing en route to review his troops at their winter quarters in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. With envoys setting out for France, Hamilton must have wondered how long his inchoate army would last. He blamed Adams's diplomacy for this threat to his army, but it also lacked the broad-based public support necessary in a democracy. The electorate did not want to pay new taxes or borrow money to maintain an expensive army and feared the uses to which Hamilton might put the troops. Even Hamilton's most ardent supporters detected waning enthusiasm. Theodore Sedgwick worried that the army everywhere to the southward is very unpopular and is growing daily more so. Treasury Secretary Wolcott told Fisher Ames that nothing is more certain than that the army is unpopular, even in the southern states for whose defense it was raised. "The northern people fear no invasion, or if they did, they perceive no security in a handful of troops." While Hamilton wove fantasies around his army, the American people were fast losing interest in any military preparations. When Adams addressed a joint session of Congress in early December, he issued no new appeals for soldiers or sailors. The confrontation between Hamilton and Adams in Trenton effectively ended their relationship. Adams could not bear to be hectored by Hamilton, who could not bear to be patronized by Adams. These two vain, ambitious men seemed to bring out the worst in each other. Instead of curtailing his plans, Hamilton reacted with more extravagant dreams. He now gazed at the world through a lens that magnified threats and obscured the chances for peace with France. He composed a long, nearly apocalyptic letter to Senator Jonathan Dayton of New Jersey, setting forth a new Federalist political agenda. This document shows a total loss of perspective by Hamilton, the nadir of his judgment. Some ideas were vintage Hamilton. The establishment of a military academy, new factories to manufacture uniforms and other army supplies, and canals to improve interstate commerce. Other ideas, however, reflected a morbidly exaggerated fear of disorder. He believed his Virginia foes were plotting to dissolve the Union and that the country was in jeopardy of civil war. He wanted more taxes to build ships and introduce longer army reenlistment periods. Showing waning faith in the good sense of the public, he wanted to strengthen state militias so they could be called out to suppress unlawful combinations and insurrections. Formerly skeptical about aspects of the Alien and Sedition Acts, he now gave them full-throated support and ranted about the need to punish people, especially the foreign-born who libeled government officials. Renegade aliens conduct more than one of the most incendiary presses in the United States, and yet in open contempt and defiance of the laws, they are permitted to continue their destructive labors. Why are they not sent away? To reduce the power wielded by Virginia, Hamilton even came up with a crackpot scheme to break up large states into smaller units. Great states will always feel a rivalship with the common head and will often be disposed to machinate against it. The subdivision of such states ought to be a cardinal point in the federal policy. It is difficult to separate this dark, vengeful letter from the setbacks in Hamilton's recent political life. Under President Washington, he had grown accustomed to great power and deference. President Adams had destroyed this sense of entitlement, and Hamilton never forgave him. The bitter face-off with Adams at Trenton confirmed that Hamilton had lost all direct influence with the president. There had been the further humiliation of the Reynolds scandal, which had mocked Hamilton's pretensions to superior private morality. He had also been greatly embittered by the pitiless censure of his enemies. His vision now appeared to be so steeped in gloom that one wonders how much depression warped his judgment in later years. The ebullient hopefulness of his early days as Treasury Secretary seemed to be in eclipse. By contrast, in these final years of the century, the abiding respect between Hamilton and Washington had ripened into real affection. On December 12, 1799, Washington sent Hamilton a letter applauding his outline for an American military academy. "The establishment of an institution of this kind has ever been considered by me as an object of primary importance to this country." It was the last letter George Washington ever wrote. After riding in a snowstorm, he developed a throat infection and died 2 days later. Washington did not live to see the government transferred to the new capital that was to bear his name. Haunted by a fear of being buried alive, he left instructions that his interment in a Mount Vernon vault should be held up for a few days after his death. Washington departed the planet as admirably as he had inhabited it. He had long hated slavery, even though he had profited from it. Now, in his will, he stipulated that his slaves should be emancipated after Martha's death, and he set aside funds for slaves who would be either too young or too old to care for themselves. Of the 9 American presidents who owned slaves, a list that includes his fellow Virginians Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, only Washington set free all of his slaves. Washington's death dealt another devastating blow to Hamilton's aspirations. For 22 years, their careers had been yoked together, and Hamilton had never needed Washington's sponsorship more urgently than now. Hamilton confided to Charles C. Pinckney after Washington's death, "Perhaps no friend of his has more cause to lament on personal account than myself. My imagination is gloomy, my heart sad." To Washington's secretary, Tobias Lear, Hamilton wrote, "I have been much indebted to the kindness of the general. He was an aegis very essential to me. If virtue can secure happiness in another world, he is happy." Not wishing to intrude upon her mourning, Hamilton waited nearly a month before writing to Martha Washington. "No one better than myself knows the greatness of your loss or how much your excellent heart is formed to feel it in all its extent." Hamilton's heartfelt sadness over Washington's death only thickened the shadows that surrounded him in his final years. Briefly, the partisan squabbling ceased as the nation paid homage to its foremost founder. On December 26, 1799, Hamilton marched in a somber procession of government dignitaries, soldiers, and horsemen that escorted a riderless white horse from Congress Hall to the German Lutheran Church, where Henry Light Horse Harry Lee of Virginia eulogized Washington as first in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen. The members of Hamilton's army wore crepe armbands in the coming months. Though Vice President Jefferson presided over the Senate in a chair draped in black, he had been alienated from Washington and boycotted the memorial service. The envious Adams found excessive the posthumous glorification of Washington and later faulted the Federalists for having done themselves and their country invaluable injury by making Washington their military, political, religious, and even moral pope and ascribing everything to him. Adams was right about one thing. The Federalists had relied too much on Washington to heal the fratricidal warfare in their party, and this made them vulnerable after his death, especially with a presidential election in the offing. Many high Federalists around Hamilton wanted to discard Adams. Governor Morris had drafted a letter to Washington right before he died, asking that he run again. Hamilton knew that Washington's death could destroy the unstable Federalist coalition. The irreparable loss of an inestimable man removes a control which was felt and was very salutary. The Hamiltonian Federalists faced a knotty dilemma, whether to acquiesce in administration policies they detested or to risk a schism in the party. Washington's death left vacant the post of commanding officer of the army, and Hamilton thought he had earned the right to it. If the president does not nominate Hamilton, said Philip Schuyler, it will evince a want of prudence and propriety, for I am persuaded that the vast majority of the American community expect that the appointment will be conferred on the general. Hamilton had struggled tirelessly and at great personal sacrifice to create a new army with 6 cavalry companies and 12 infantry regiments. But having regretted naming Hamilton to the number 2 position, Adams was not about to cede the top position to him, which therefore remained unfilled. Hamilton did succeed Washington as President General of the Society of the Cincinnati. Time ran out on Hamilton's military ambitions. By February 1800, Congress halted enlistments for the new army that he was assembling and that had monopolized his valuable time. That same month, Americans learned that Napoleon Bonaparte had eliminated the Directory in November and pronounced himself First Consul in precisely the turn to despotism that Hamilton had long prophesied for France. The fulfillment of his prediction, however, left him stranded in an awkward situation. Napoleon's coup marked the end of the French Revolution and thereby weakened the case for military preparations against a country that the Federalists had identified with Jacobinism. Hamilton saw his vision of a brand new army evaporate. It is very certain that the military career in this country offers too few inducements, and it is equally certain that my present station in the army cannot very long continue under the plans which seem to govern, he told a friend. But as spring arrived, Hamilton still could not surrender his daydreams for the American military. With his hyperactive mind, he drafted a bill for a military academy encompassing the Navy as well as the Army, and another for an Army Corps of Engineers. He refined his guidelines for infantry training right down to the correct pace for marching. 75 steps per minute for the common step, 120 per minute for the quick step. Hamilton was spinning his wheels. When Congress gave Adams the power in mid-May to disband most of the new army, he quickly exercised it. By this point, Adams thought Hamilton's army an abomination and later recalled that it was as unpopular as if it had been a ferocious wild beast let loose upon the nation to devour it. Adams quipped grimly that if the venturesome Hamilton had been given a free hand with the army, he would have needed a second army to disband the first. Hamilton tried to keep up a brave face, but he was heartbroken over his ill-fated corps. He told Eliza that he had to play the game of good spirits, but it is a most artificial game, and at the bottom of my soul there is a more than usual gloom. He was unaccustomed to failure, and here he had devoted a year and a half of his life to an aborted army. On May 22, 1800, he emerged from his tent at Scotch Plains to review his troops one last time before they were demobilized in mid-June. Abigail Adams was present and, despite her dislike of Hamilton, was impressed by his troops. "They did great honor to their officers and to themselves," she told her sister. At the beginning of July, Hamilton shut up his New York headquarters, notified the Secretary of War of his departure, and ended his military service. The taxing, dispiriting episode was over in every respect but one. He had not yet discharged his full store of bitterness against the president whom he held responsible for this inglorious end. Chapter 35. Gusts of Passion. Even while carrying out his duties as Inspector General of a nascent army, Hamilton made time for the occasional legal case. He had seldom gravitated to criminal cases, preferring civil cases with substantial constitutional issues or commercial cases that generated adequate fees. On those infrequent occasions when he took criminal cases, he usually defended the underdog on a pro bono basis, evidence that once again challenges the historic stereotype of Hamilton as an imperious snob. Such a case arose in the spring of 1800 when he thought a likable young carpenter named Levi Weeks was being unjustly accused of murder. As in the post-war loyalist cases, Hamilton was disturbed whenever public opinion howled for bloody revenge. In the annals of New York crime, the Levi Weeks case is often called the Manhattan Well tragedy, and it forms yet another chapter in the convoluted relationship of Hamilton and Aaron Burr. At first glance, the case seemingly involved an innocent maiden betrayed by an unfeeling cad. On the snowy evening of December 22, 1799, Julielma Sands, about 22, left her boarding house on Greenwich Street, which was operated by her respectable Quaker relatives, Catherine and Elias Ring. It was believed that she had gone off to marry her fiancé, Levi Weeks, who was also a tenant and was seen chatting with her before her departure. Later that night, Weeks returned to the Ring household alone, inquired if Sands had gone to bed, and was shocked to discover that she was not there. On January 2nd, her fully dressed corpse was fished from a wooden well owned by the Manhattan Company. Perhaps because he had founded the company, Aaron Burr joined with Hamilton and Brockholst Livingston to defend Levi Weeks against a murder charge. The corpse of Julielma Sands was mottled and swollen and badly bruised around the face and breasts. The public was riveted by these gory details, and handbills insinuated that she had been impregnated and then murdered by Weeks. Elias and Catherine Ring egged on this speculation, with Elias recalling that when Weeks came home on the evening of Sands' disappearance, he appeared as white as ashes and trembled all over like a leaf. The Rings even engaged in some macabre showmanship at their boarding house. They displayed Sands's body in a coffin for 3 days and then placed it for a day on the pavement outside, allowing people to gratify their ghoulish curiosity and decide whether she had been pregnant. The inquest said she had not. As the uproar against Levi Weeks reached a crescendo, "Scarcely anything else is spoken of," said one local diarist, "gossips whispered of ghostly apparitions at the Manhattan Well." The prosecution of Weeks assumed the vengeful mood of a witch hunt. The indictment said that not having the fear of God before his eyes, but being moved and seduced by the instigation of the devil, Weeks had beaten and abused Sands before murdering her and stuffing her down the well. The People v. Levi Weeks began on March 31st at the old City Hall on Wall Street, the Federal Hall of Washington's first inauguration. Such a huge throng showed up that constables had to empty the courtroom of superfluous spectators. Levi Weeks could hear crowds outside chanting for his blood, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" The case holds a special place in Hamilton's legal practice because William Coleman, a court clerk and later editor of the New York Evening Post, provided an almost complete stenographic transcript, a novelty in those days. Unfortunately, Coleman did not specify which defense lawyer spoke at any given moment, though we can make some educated guesses. For instance, the grandiloquent lawyer who opened the defense case spoke in a florid style reminiscent of Hamilton rather than the more succinct Burr. I know the unexampled industry that has been exerted to destroy the reputation of the accused and to immolate him at the shrine of persecution without the solemnity of a candid and impartial trial. We have witnessed the extraordinary means which have been adopted to inflame the public passions and to direct the fury of popular resentment against the prisoner. Why has the body been exposed for days in the public streets in a manner the most indecent and shocking? In this way, gentlemen, the public opinion comes to be formed unfavorably, and long before the prisoner is brought to his trial, he is already condemned. It seems mystifying that Levi Weeks could have assembled a team composed of the three preeminent lawyers in New York. Hamilton could scarcely have warmed to Burr after the Manhattan Company sham, and was likely motivated by his friendship with Ezra Weeks, Levi's brother, whom he had hired to construct a weekend home north of the city. Another likely reason why Hamilton collaborated with Burr is that the trial occurred on the eve of local elections that were to have profound national implications. None of the three lawyers could afford to miss a chance to publicize his talents in a spectacular criminal case. The trial unfolded with a speed that seems unimaginable today. 55 witnesses testified in 3 days, each day's testimony lasting well past midnight. The rigorous defense team established a credible alibi for Levi Weeks, claiming that he had dined with Ezra on the night in question. During that dinner, John B. McComb, Jr., the architect hired for Hamilton's new home, arrived and found a cheerful Levi stowing away a hearty dinner. From medical experts, the defense elicited helpful opinions that the marks on Julielma Sands's body might have been produced by drowning or by the autopsy itself, opening up the possibility of suicide. The coroner's inquest had established drowning, not beating, as the cause of death. The defense lawyers also discredited the testimony of Elias and Catherine Ring, showing that Elias Ring had probably slept with Julielma Sands, and that Sands, no innocent damsel, had a little weakness for laudanum. The image of the Ring household evolved from a scene of violated gentility into something closer to a sedate brothel. As the trial proceeded, the defense cast suspicion on a Richard Croucher, a shady salesman of ladies' garments, who had zealously stirred up malice against Levi Weeks. Croucher had arrived from England the year before and was yet another raffish lodger at the steamy Ring premises. As principal witness for the prosecution, he seemed too eager to retail stories about sexual liaisons between Levi Weeks and Julielma Sands. The defense lawyers damaged Croucher's credibility by getting him to confess that he had quarreled with Weeks. It has become part of Hamiltonian legend that when Croucher testified, Hamilton placed candles on both sides of his face, giving his features a sinister glow. The jury will mark every muscle of his face, every motion of his eye, Hamilton is said to have declaimed. I conjure you to look through that man's countenance to his conscience. Croucher supposedly confessed on the spot. Oddly enough, Aaron Burr later claimed that he had grabbed two candelabra from the defense table, held them toward Croucher, and declared theatrically, "Behold the murderer, gentlemen!" Traumatized by this exposure, the guilty Croucher was alleged to have bolted in terror from the courtroom. Coleman's transcript shows when the famous moment may have occurred. One witness was testifying to Croucher's unsavory character when, Coleman noted, here one of the prisoner's counsel held a candle close to Croucher's face, who stood among the crowd and asked the witness if it was he, and he said it was. Hamilton or Burr may have flicked the candle toward Croucher in a rapid gesture that made him appear to cringe guiltily in the glare of a burning taper. The lodger never confessed to the crime. The likelihood that Croucher, not Weeks, was the culprit increased 3 months later when he was convicted of raping a 13-year-old girl at the Racy Ring boarding house. The protracted case ended at 1:30 in the morning on April 2, 1800. The bleary-eyed prosecutor had not slept for 44 hours, and Hamilton noted that everyone was sinking under fatigue. Hamilton therefore waived the right to a summation, saying he would rest the case on the recital of the facts by the bench. Hamilton felt confident that the case required no labored elucidation. He and his colleagues had convincingly shown that Levi Weeks had a watertight alibi, that the evidence against him was circumstantial, and that he possessed no motive for butchering his fiancée. The jury agreed. William Coleman ended his transcript. The jury then went out and returned in about 5 minutes with a verdict. Not guilty. It was a triumph for the defense and a hideous embarrassment for Elias and Catherine Ring. As Hamilton strode from the courtroom, Catherine Ring waved a fist in his face and shouted, "If thee dies a natural death, I shall think there is no justice in heaven." While Hamilton and Burr bestrode the Wall Street courtroom, they knew that local elections for the state legislature in late April might affect much more than New York politics. They might determine the next president of the United States. With John Adams certain to run strongly in New England and Thomas Jefferson equally so in the South, the election would hinge on pivotal votes in the mid-Atlantic states, particularly New York, which had 12 electoral votes. The Constitution gave each state the right to choose its own method for selecting presidential electors, and New York picked its by a joint ballot of the two houses of the legislature, both now with Federalist majorities, yet with the upstate counties evenly split between Republicans and Federalists. The New York City elections that spring could tip the balance of the legislature one way or the other. Thus, as New York City went, so went the state, and possibly the nation. Jefferson realized this and advised Madison in early March that if the city election of New York is in favor of the Republican ticket, then the national winner might be Republican. Within Hamilton's Federalist coterie, the April elections arose as the best chance to blunt John Adams's re-election bid and substitute a more congenial Federalist candidate. Robert Troup wrote to Rufus King, "This election will be all important, and particularly so as there is a decided and deep-rooted disgust with Mr. Adams on the part of his best old friends." The centrality of the New York City elections presented an unprecedented opportunity for that most dexterous opportunist, Aaron Burr, who knew that the Republicans wanted to achieve geographic balance on their national ticket by having a northern vice presidential candidate. If he could deliver New York into the Republican camp, he might parlay that feat into a claim on the second spot under Jefferson. In the polarized atmosphere of American politics, Burr knew that a northern renegade aligned with southern Republicans could provide a critical swing factor. This was Alexander Hamilton's recurring nightmare, an electoral deal struck between Virginia and New York Republicans. In the New York City elections that spring, Hamilton and Burr descended from the lofty heights to spar in the grit and bustle of Lower Manhattan ward politics. On April 15th, Hamilton met with his Federalist adherents at the Tontine City Hotel and drew up a largely undistinguished slate of candidates for the state assembly. It was composed of an atypical, for the Federalists, cross-section of New Yorkers, with a potter, a mason, a ship chandler, a grocer, and two booksellers. This may have been a strategy to outflank the Republicans, or it may have reflected the reluctance of many wealthy Federalists to put in time as poorly paid state legislators, especially with the state capital now transferred to Albany. Burr, with his customary craft, waited for Hamilton to present his slate before revealing his own. When Burr scanned a sheet naming the Federalist candidates, he read it over with great gravity, folded it up, put it in his pocket, and said, "Now I have him all hollow," said John Adams. The suave Burr packed his slate with gray eminences. He cajoled the perennial ex-governor George Clinton out of retirement and added the aging Horatio Gates, still feeding off his wartime victory at Saratoga, as well as Brockhorst Livingston, his recent co-counsel. An early master of the art of coalition politics, Burr made common cause with Clintonians and Livingstons to present a redoubtable united front. Hamilton thought Burr had engaged in deceptive window dressing by padding his slate with luminaries who had no real intention of serving in the state legislature and cared only about the selection of Republican electors in the presidential race. Unlike other contemporary politicians, Burr enjoyed the nitty-gritty of such campaigns and embraced the electioneering they disdained. End of Disc 24.